Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it. Today we have an excellent show as we explore the bowels of e-discovery. You know, I used to think the bowels of e-discovery projects were the review rooms, which is where I used to be involved in setting up. And at this point, I now believe the true bowels of the case is the oldest ESI, which sits around either in litigation holds that have sat around for a while or in backup tapes or archive servers and other storage devices. This is the attic for organizations who like to keep ESI for a rainy day only to be tortured by adverse parties and helpful consultants on how to deal with this problem. Everyone who's ever dealt with this stuff wants to get rid of it, but how do you do it in a cost-effective manner that's defensible? If this was daytime TV, this would be the show about obesity and trying to get back into shape. And while this area might not pack the entertainment punch of The Biggest Loser, I'm sure this panel is well aware of organizations which could be on that ESI equivalent reality show if it existed. After we initially talk about this problem and why this is a risk not to be pushed under the rug, then hopefully we can move into providing some useful tips on how to deal with this problem, why you should deal with it, and how to get on the path of successful ESI management. We have an excellent panel to attack this topic, as we have a lawyer who understands the legal risks, a technology company which creates tools to address the risks, and a consultant who is managing projects to reduce legacy data volumes. So now let's introduce the panelists. First, we have Alicia Ficone, who actually proposed this topic, and she's a member of New Jersey-based McCarter & English's Business and Financial Services Litigation Practice Group. She joined the firm in 2004 after previously practicing in Los Angeles and New York at two international law firms. Alicia regularly practices in federal and state courts in New York and New Jersey and is also licensed to practice in California and Washington, D.C. She has extensive experience in all facets of electronic discovery and production. In recent years, she was one of a team of lawyers at McCarter & English responsible for managing close to 1,000 attorneys who achieved the timely production of over 25 million pages of documents in a multi-district litigation in the Central District of Florida. To date, that's one of the largest, most compressed e-discovery production efforts in the history of electronic discovery. Since that time, her practice has focused extensively on matters involving e-discovery issues, and accordingly, she has had the occasion to spearhead the electronic review and production of documents in matters of varying size and complexity. As a result of the role she played in the successful MDL review and production and subsequent cases involving e-discovery, she's become one of McCarter English's specialists in this area of litigation practice, and she routinely advises clients on records management and ESI issues. As such, Alicia is a frequent speaker on issues related to e-discovery, both within the firm to educate their lawyers and as a firm spokesperson to a variety of industry and professional groups on different levels of ESI experience. She's also the co-chair of McCarter & English's eDiscovery Committee and is a member of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production. Gary Rylander is the CEO of Strategic Governance Solutions. SGS provides information governance consulting and solutions in the domains of compliance, records management, and eDiscovery. Prior to founding SGS, Gary was a partner in IBM's risk and compliance practice, where he led the information governance records management and e-discovery practice. Previous to that, he was associated with the KPMG's Pete Marwick litigation support provider, CACI, CBS Incorporated's Law and Business Affairs Department, and Kravath, Swain, and more. Gary blogs at Compliance Guys. Lastly, we have a repeat guest, Jim McCann, who's the Vice President in Information Discovery with Index Engines. Jim has extensive experience with e-discovery and information management. He's currently contributing to the Sedona Working Group addressing electronic document retention and production. Jim's also a frequent speaker for industry organizations such as ARMA, ILTA, and has authored multiple articles for legal technology and information management publications. So first of all, I'd sort of like to ask how everyone got involved with e-discovery. Why don't we start with you, Alicia, and then Gary, and then Jim.
Okay. Thanks, Carl. Well, this has gone back about 6 or 7 years ago, actually, when I first came over to McCarter, and I got involved in a case with multiple defendants, and the plaintiff was the government. And the government decided to produce to the various defendants about over a million pages of documents in single-page TIFFs that I had to sit at my desk and open single page by single page by single page. And I thought, this is crazy. And from then on, I sort of became more interested and involved how to better organize and structure the review of these types of documents in large and complex litigation matters. And then, as you said, more recently, but still several years ago, I became involved in this major, crazy 25-million-page electronic review and production. And pretty much after that, I was hooked and pegged, and there was no turning back.
Great. Hey, it's amazing how when you actually are doing search and retrieval with things that don't make sense, how that, you know, makes an impression. I did single word searching in a 4-year piece of litigation, one summation, and I was the person doing the searches, and I thought, this is insane. This is like building the pyramids.
Exactly.
But anyway, okay, Gary, yourself, you have an interesting background too.
Well, yeah, my first job out of school was working at Cravath, Swain & Moore on the U.S. v. IBM and U.S. v. CBS antitrust cases. And the IBM case was the great-grandfather of electronic discovery. IBM was one of the few companies in the world back in the late 70s that had a good chunk of its information stored in databases and was using email. And as a consequence, some of the earliest decisions back in the days of data compilations before the under the 72 revisions to Federal Rules of Civil Procedure involved both the U.S. v. IBM antitrust cases and a lot of the private actions around that. So I became involved back then. In fact, here's a little bit of historical e-discovery trivia. IBM created the world's first e-discovery product called STAIRS to defend itself on that case. And later on, as the technology moved on, so did I. But back in those days, we did discovery mostly with paper and microfilm and mainframes.
Okay, and Jim?
Hey, thanks, Carl. I wasn't really involved in the paper phase, but here at Index Engines, we got involved in the electronic discovery about 5-6 years ago, really, when legal teams started reaching out to us to help make their electronic information just more discoverable. I mean, really on the information management side, and we got quickly dragged into the whole e-discovery game.
Okay, so let's jump into the topic now, Gary. How does a company tell it has a legacy data problem, or is litigation really the only practical way to say, oops, why do we have all of this?
Well, actually, if you have legacy data, then you have a legacy data problem. And my experience over the past few years has actually been coming into projects mostly from the perspective of risk and compliance and information governance being the impetus for addressing legacy data rather than litigation. The cost to most of my large financial services clients for keeping all this legacy data is just immense. And we all know from industry studies that, you know, there's on average something like a 50% over-retention rate of information, meaning that if you look at a data set, more than 50% of it should probably have been deleted under the retention schedule currently in place, but it isn't, so it hangs around. And same thing with duplication rates. There's more than a 20-to-1 duplication rate of both structured and unstructured information in most large companies. And it just builds up and builds up. And you alluded to the problem earlier. It's difficult to winnow that pile of digital garbage down if you can't separate the wheat from the chaff, if you can't separate what you need to keep both for purposes of legal hold as well as retention from what you can get rid of. So the problem is out there. Most firms are aware of it, but struggle with how to solve it until they talk to somebody who's been doing this for a while and knows how to do it and applies the right tools and mechanisms to approach the problem.
So, Jim, how big of a problem is legacy data removal, and is it your sense that it's getting bigger, or are we making progress in the field?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, legacy data, you know, builds up over time, and unless you have a policy in place that avoids the continued building of legacy data. You're going to stockpile it, and it's going to grow and grow. I mean, you've got to stop it at some point. One of the biggest challenges is that it's growing because users are still creating data. You're not going to stop them from doing that. That's the intellectual property of a company. But at the same time, on the legal side, you know, issues like the burden argument is eroding. You know, there used to be companies that we would talk to years ago when we talk about legacy data, and most legacy data sits on old backup tapes, pretty much. It gets stored offsite, and we talk about those old tapes that are there. And they're saying, you know, for us, we don't want to touch it. We're successful using the burden argument. But now that judges are becoming more technical and there's a lot of opinions that are out there that are really talking about backup tapes and old legacy data, you know, with the regulatory issues, government oversight and so on, you know, it's kind of the data's building and regulatory issues are growing and the technology is being come, you know, widely adapted. So between those three issues, it's kind of coming to a head.
Gary, sounds like the perfect storm for you. But
anyway,
well, Alicia, we'll continue adding the perfect storm. What are the legal risks from holding on to too much legacy data?
It's interesting. You know, what Jim was talking about is sort of a perfect lead-in to where we need to talk about what the legal risks are from holding on to too much legacy data. And I guess the first point would be is the biggest risk is actually having to produce it and the cost that would be associated with it. But the case law is, in fact, catching up to technology, or I guess the technology is catching up to the case law, depending on who you speak to. But I think the bottom line here is inaccessible, that fallback position, may not be so inaccessible anymore. I mean, take the big case that came down this year everybody's talking about, Pension Committee, and Judge Shindlin, fear into the hearts of lawyers and clients alike with the term gross negligence. But one of the definitions of gross negligence in that case was a failure to preserve backup tapes when they are the sole source of relevant information or if they relate to key players or custodians in the case. Again, that's not necessarily obtainable from other sources, but she's putting it out there. Rule 26B2B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that lawyers talk about all the time is what sets the inaccessibility standard. And it says that a party doesn't have to provide discovery of ESI sources that party identifies as not reasonably accessible due to undue burden or cost. But it's that party's burden to demonstrate inaccessibility, because the general presumption with respect to discovery is that data is accessible and that the burden is on the party disputing accessibility to prove it. We had a case in the District of New Jersey last year called Major Tours versus Colorel. And interestingly enough, it was a case about a litigation hold. And the court found that whether relevant emails had been preserved was a factor in deciding whether it would be burdensome to retrieve archived email. And perhaps even a bigger point about that particular case for purposes of our discussion is the court provided guidance for the rebuttal of the not reasonably accessible burden argument, and it made it clear that the decision was based in that case on the lack of detail in rebutting the argument about inaccessibility, sort of lending itself to the inference that perhaps if there had been greater evidence on rebuttal, that inaccessibility might not have been how the court found in that case. So I think we're in a place now where the seminal Zuba Lake reasoning that backup tapes are simply a matter of disaster recovery and routinely deemed to be inaccessible is changing. It's changing because of technology that companies like Jim have, and backup tapes are often easier and less expensive to restore. In fact, my last point is, from a legal perspective, the advisory note to Rule 26B2 from the amendments in 2006 included a proposal to say that backup tapes were reasonably inaccessible sources of data, but it was rejected in order to keep the amendment open to possible emerging technologies. So I think organizations can no longer rest comfortably on what, you know, basically saying they have no time to delete legacy data now. They have no time to deal with it because it might be far more costly to produce it later.
Boy, what a great setup for the next question. Jim, what are the solutions to evaluating legacy data?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I mean, Alicia's hit the nail on the head there that companies really need to stop accepting that it's burdensome. And technology, I mean, we've done a lot of work with tapes, and we're finding that companies, you know, for what it's basically costing them to store it annually, it could become discoverable. And I think you do see some, you know, historical cases where tape discovery was in the, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands even of dollars per tape, which is now just a ridiculous number. So, you know, what companies need to do is develop a policy. So a policy, and the policy needs to include that legacy data. So there's technology. I mean, we're definitely, you know, blazing the trail here on making that content discoverable. And you can simply develop a, you know, a data map of that content by scanning the headers of the tapes and developing an understanding of what servers contained on those tapes, what emails contained on those tapes, and so on. And I think Gary's going to talk, follow me up on this, as far as having someone, an advisor, that can help you with that policy and process, because you have to really understand technology and understand legal policy in order to really build, you know, evaluate those legacy data environments.
So, Gary, is it possible to develop an ROI to sell legacy ESI removal projects? And I'm interested not only in just the really large sort of financial services companies that you experience, but also just mid-sized companies. And then what are the largest cost components in a legacy ESI removal project?
Well, it's actually very, very easy to build an ROI to get rid of legacy data. The costs continue to come down. You've got solutions like index engines, which make it a highly automated process and make it possible to search for custodians, key persons in legal holds. I mean, we're working on one project now with index engines involving some 300,000 backup tapes and over 30,000 custodians, and it's a largely automated process to go after the email and the file shares and those sorts of things. If you also need to go after structured data, there are other steps that need to be taken to deal with that as well. And actually, we've been thinking about this mostly in terms of email, but for a lot of my clients, the fact that they may have thousands of custom structured applications is a somewhat thornier legacy problem, but there are also data archiving tools that are available that can be used once you use something like index engines to pull it off the tape that allow you to also search for potentially relevant ESI in structured applications. The largest component of doing a project like this is the hardware and software that's required to pull the information back off tape and to make a determination, in almost all cases, an automated determination as to whether or not you're dealing with something that is responsive to a legal hold. The benefits, however, are considerably larger. And you think about the fact that you've got firms that are paying Iron Mountain tens of millions of dollars a year to store legacy tapes, or they've got their own tape bunker set up. In many cases, you've got software maintenance costs associated with this legacy information. And when you take all of that together, as well as the softer dollar legal risk costs associated with more extensive discovery and potentially liability that wouldn't be there without that legacy data. If you take all that into combination, I found that most of my clients are looking at a payback period of less than a year. Now, admittedly, most of my clients over the past few years have been larger firms rather than smaller firms, but the same principles should apply to smaller firms as well.
You know, I just thought of something here, and I was talking to someone recently that has similar problem with legacy data through litigation holds, and, you know, we were talking to them about basically the, you know, thinking of who the logical people would be involved in the case, the custodians, and then doing some thinking about who you're going to be doing the litigation hold on. And the lawyer involved asked actually a good question. I'm a little uncomfortable saying that I'm making the choice when then we meet with the other side and we're talking. I mean, defensibility always seems to rear its ugly head somewhere in the process, at least multiple times. So when you're making those types of calls, Jim, on what you're getting rid of, especially when litigation is involved, is that a thorny issue?
Well, it depends on the type of case. I mean, is it a reactive case? I mean, are you collecting data for a specific active case, or is it really just proactive, house cleaning? So I think,
Actually, let me clarify. A lot of companies have multiple cases ongoing.
Right.
They don't start at, okay, now we're going to get rid of our data. They have litigation holds already in effect, and that's sometimes when they realize they have a problem.
Right.
How do we look backwards and get rid of some of this stuff?
Yeah. Well, I know, Gary mentioned a project that we're working with him on a large bank, but a lot of the working up to the project, a lot of the process was developing that methodology that had defensibility, and we took a lot of the Sedona guidelines and incorporated those into that process. But one of the key issues in these projects is getting someone like a consultant like Gary that understands the policies and procedures and processes and builds a defensible process using technology. I mean, the technology is not going to do it alone.
Well, Jim, what's interesting is I find on my side and the projects I've been involved in that one of the biggest issues is overly broad and vague legal holds. I had one client, a large insurance company, that had something like 25 overlapping holds on its entire claim system. And what that client decided to do is it called in its primary litigators and began to examine those holes and push back on them, and in some cases move for protective orders where they couldn't get opposing counsel to agree to something that was a bit more focused. Everybody talks about this, but it's very true that these types of projects require very close coordination between legal and IT.
Yeah, Alicia, I'm sure you've got some opinions on this because we're making judgment calls now on what's already been held. Maybe it's overly broad. As a lawyer, outside lawyer, what do you think about this?
Well, that's absolutely true. And as a lawyer, I've drafted broad discovery requests, and I've been on the receiving end of broad discovery requests for various strategic reasons. But it really all comes down to, and I know this is a word everybody hates to hear, but it's true, it comes down to reasonableness. It comes down to making reasonable, defensible decisions based on sound business practices, based on your retention schedules, the regulatory issues and that your subject may be subject to, and then, yes, your litigations. But, I was just out at the Sedona annual meeting last week where there are always a bunch of judges, and they had the same thing to say, not with respect to legacy data specifically, but with respect to all issues, especially involving sanctions-type issues and mistakes that are made along the way in the discovery process. But it's doing nothing that is generally considered to be not defensible, whereas if you're making sound, reasoned decisions, then you're in a far better place when it comes to running up into court and having to defend your position. So to the extent that you might be faced with broad requests, that's true, but you need to be able to work within those requests and still try to make sound, reasonable decisions.
So we've heard both Jim and Gary talk about the record retention policy, Alicia. Again, from the outside lawyer perspective, what role does that record retention policy play with legacy data?
You know what, Carl? I love talking about record retention policies because as a lawyer, it's so rare that you get to make affirmative statements without saying probably, possibly, or most likely. So when I talk to clients or when I talk to other people about these types of issues, I can always say, you must have a record retention policy. Your record retention policy must address these issues. So it's the same with legacy data. I think they're part and parcel of the same thing. You need to have three primary components to be able to address any issue. One, information should always be retained as long as it has business-related value to an organization or it's required by a law or regulation to be preserved. I mean, that's basically a no-brainer. Again, getting back to what I was talking about before, companies and organizations must take reasonable steps to preserve certain information that's relevant. Again, you know, fuzzy terms in actual or reasonably anticipated litigation. And that's true whether or not it actually constitutes a formal record of the organization. And if it doesn't meet either of those two criteria, you can destroy it. In fact, you should destroy it. There's no reason to maintain all the costs that are associated with keeping that type of legacy data around. But the record retention policy and addressing the legacy data problem are inextricably intertwined.
I absolutely agree. In fact, almost every project that I've been involved with has dealt with records retention. Legal hold is part and parcel of the same project.
In fact, I guess if you look at the Sedona commentary on legacy data that was published a few years ago, they discuss it in terms of two problems, quote-unquote, and they look at it in two different directions. There's the backward-looking problem of addressing and destroying irrelevant accumulated legacy data, and there's the forward-looking problem of using policies and procedures to reduce future accumulation. So even if your organization is not in a place where you can deal right now immediately with all of your past backward-looking legacy data, unless you talk to Gary and Jim and you're clued into how great all that stuff is, from a record retention policy perspective going forward, you can take steps now, low-cost, no-cost steps by updating your policy to think about looking forward, especially as we're talking about further exponential increase of ESI data and data hoarding that probably will go on in order to stem the tide.
Boy, it's unbelievable. About 40 podcasts ago, I did a show trying to find the similarities between legal holds and records management. I don't think we quite hit it. I knew there was a strong connection there, but you guys articulated it really well. I might cut that last answer and paste it in an old podcast. But anyway.
Carl, I think I have the icing on the cake for this argument, and that is a study I read just yesterday, a new study published by AIM, where more than 700 respondents were queried about records management and e-discovery and legal holds. And one of the things that they said was, when you use a records management, an electronic records management system to manage your records in precisely the way that Alicia was talking about, disposing of things when they should be disposed of based on their retention periods, it halved the time and presumably the cost of doing e-discovery.
So, Jim, are there inexpensive ways to identify old data and get rid of it, and how do you see technology playing into reducing manpower?
Yeah, it definitely is. So if you think about, you know, all the data that gets moved out onto legacy tapes, you know, we find that typically less than 5% of it is data that needs to be on litigation hold or retained, future litigation or for compliance reasons. So, you know, having to restore those tapes and move everything off of tape is really where the expense comes in. So it's more of a traditional approach. You know, restoration is expensive because it needs the original environment, and you have to move all the data off of tape before you can start really discovering it and figuring out what's what on the tape. So the approach that we've taken is really more intelligent extraction. We don't use restoration. It's an extraction of content. So by, you know, in scanning the tapes, you can create a searchable index without moving anything off tape, search the index, find custodians, find mailboxes, find any intellectual property you need, and then rip that content from tape without using the backup software. So, you know, for example, we had a project that one of our partners did on the West Coast. It was for a SEC investigation where there was 1,200 tapes involved. And in the past, that would have cost millions of dollars to do discovery on those tapes. This partner did that project in 47 days, found what they need, and extracted it from tape. And it ended up being the total amount of data on those 1,200 tapes was about half a petabyte or about 500 terabytes of data. And then the data was extracted in 47 days and processed at a very cost-effective number. So, you know, the technology has definitely caught up and, you know, change the more traditional process to a more automated process.
So, Gary, are there any hybrid approaches you can do, do you think, to take a look at the future, realizing you got a legacy problem, but instead of worrying about the past, I mean, let's not worry about what happened in the old days. I know we have a legacy problem, but let's look forward. Let's do this incrementally.
Yeah, I think you have to take a hybrid approach, because if you don't deal with the reasons that mountain of legacy data built up, then even if you clean up the attic, it's simply going to fill up again. So you have to deal with both. And dealing with both means not only the things we've been talking about today, but it also means an appropriate records management policy, which usually can have shorter retention periods than most people have today. I find that there are a lot of so-called business justifications for keeping legacy data, which aren't really valid. And you interview people and ask them, you ask the folks in IT, well, when is the last time, other than discovery purposes, that somebody from the business came and asked for a 10-year-old piece of information? You find that it's virtually never. So you have to push back on that. And one of the reasons that people keep so much information is because of the way that they don't do chargebacks for IT. So it becomes this amorphous overhead cost rather than being charged back to the business unit. If it doesn't cost you anything to store legacy information, then there's a natural tendency to keep everything. So you need to address all of those things going forward, as well as cleaning up the legacy information. And you know, what's sort of interesting about, people have this perception that this is an amazingly difficult, time-consuming process, and nobody's ever been able to do it. But over the past couple of years, I've worked on a number of projects involving failed banks that were acquired by other banks. And the acquiring banks decided they didn't want to acquire the IT assets of the failed banks, so the FDIC required that the acquiring bank create an archive of 10 years of virtually all of the information that was important to running that failed bank, and to maintain it for 6 years going forward, in conditions that really related to an anticipation of litigation. It turns out that within less than 6 months, for all of these failed banks, it's possible to go in there, suck up the information on thousands of desktops and laptops, suck up all the information on all of the servers, both structured and unstructured, use tools like index engines or other tools that I used at IBM, like Exaros and Optum, to go and scour the information for what is subject to legal hold, and build a repository. If you can do that in 6 months when the FDIC twists your arm to get it done, then it's clear that a lot of other firms can also do that without that pressure.
So I forgot to ask this, but good lead-in. Jim, what's the right way to approach a legacy ESI issue? I mean, who's sitting at the table? You know, and the converse of that is, what's the wrong way to approach this type of issue?
Good question. So, you know, when we started talking to legal organizations years ago, they never really brought IT into the room. They tried to do these projects, you know, on their own. And they were smaller scale projects, and they were, you know, reacting to specific litigation. So, you know, it was complex, but it was something that legal could manage, and IT got involved on a peripheral level. You know, now we're seeing IT's stronger involvement from IT, which is where they're coming in and solving the problem for the business, as opposed to just providing you know, a specific support for a project. But the key piece of the puzzle really is you know, a playbook, as we call it, someone that has the process developed that's defensible and so on. And organizations such as Gary is instrumental in some of these projects that we're working on. He comes in and basically bridges between IT and legal, and helps develop the process and the methodology. So, you know, definitely at the table is going to be, you know, IT on one side, legal on the other side, and a you know, a consultant such as Gary in the middle that helps with the playbook and the process. The wrong way to do it is if it's just, if there's no methodology or playbook defined, then it becomes very kind of haphazard, and there's it's not a defensible process, and it just becomes a long, drawn out, more complex than it needs to be project.
Okay, and that leads up to who's on the hook if a mistake's made with getting rid of legacy ESI. I'll ask our legal counsel on the call, Alicia.
Well, I think anybody involved in the process could potentially be on the hook, but certainly If it's done wrong, counsel could be on the hook, clients could be on the hook, either directly or indirectly. I mean, there's potential sanctions if you're talking about a legal hold in a litigation context. You could be talking about the HR department or the IT department of your organization who have to face unhappy superiors if something is not done properly. I mean, even counsel, to the extent that counsel might not be as potentially sanctionable as, say, a client might be, they still will have to deal with unhappy clients or maybe the loss of a client if things are not done properly. However, I think that mistakes will be made both by not addressing how to deal with legacy data and sometimes even when you're attempting in good faith to deal with legacy data issues. I mean, let's face it, we're all just human. It's a lot of data. I mean, just in one of the answers before, we talked about terabytes and petabytes, and I remember reading an article last year talking about the next several iterations of what we're going to call bytes, and it went up to 27 zeros, and I can't even remember what the number was called because, you know, I went to law school, so I wouldn't have to do math for the rest of my life. But the last word was a brontobyte. I mean, how can anybody even conceive of what a brontobyte might be? But I think the fear of potentially making a mistake shouldn't stop us from actually taking affirmative action to prevent mistakes. To prevent mistakes by keeping the data, to prevent mistakes by intelligently and systematically making sound decisions. And just to add on to what Jim just said, in addition to having the right people at the table, and I'm the lawyer so I say this, you've got to write everything down. You've got to document everything. You document your processes, you document your procedures, you document your rationales and your justifications. And then you're in a far better place to be able to justify the actions that you took in the event somebody alleges a mistake has been made.
You know, Alicia, I'm curious how you're going to answer this next question because it's related. You know, I want to know how hard it is to get an outside lawyer to sign off on the destruction of ESI because I know how hard it is to get them to, you know, get rid of linear review and keywords and you know, do cost-effective concept searching. You know, it's reasonable, defensible. People bounce back and forth between the two.
I know. Well, it always brings to mind. Remember your Greek mythology from high school, and there was that guy called Sisyphus. He was the king that got punished by being compelled to push the boulder up the hill, only to watch it roll back down and have to repeat this throughout eternity. That's what I think of when you ask me this question. But lawyers do give legal opinions all the time. I mean, they do. That's what we are engaged to do. It's part of what clients ask us to do. And, yes, we're not going to render a legal opinion unless we give careful consideration, investigation, analysis to the process. And the same is true here. But that does not mean that we will not give an opinion. And in fact, I think it's incumbent upon us to give an opinion as a key part of this process with IT, with Gary, and with formulating a plan in order to address this issue. The key is really knowing your clients well, knowing what their requirements are from a regulatory perspective, knowing as outside counsel the scope of their litigations and what litigation holds require them to keep. And to the extent you do your homework, I feel it's incumbent upon you to be able to sign off on what you're advising your clients to do.
So now I think we've probably covered everything we need to cover, but I'll give you each a final shot at giving a best tip for dealing with legacy data, even if it's a recap of something you already said. I'll start with Alicia, then Gary, then Jim.
Well, one of the things I've been talking a lot about lately is some of the risk of ESI loss in conjunction with terminations that have gone on because of this economic recession. So one of the things I would say is don't let your employees leave behind the wrong kinds of legacies. You want to make sure that all your employees are interviewed, that you know where their data repositories are, you know where documents exist, and you never let somebody walk out the door without having that information, which can become part and parcel of your legacy data plan. And again, I would stress document retention policies and schedules. Take affirmative steps looking back, but most definitely take affirmative steps going forward to avoid the accumulation.
Okay, Gary.
Okay, I would start by saying don't boil the ocean. take a risk-based approach. Start with a couple of your largest, most expensive, riskiest areas like email and perhaps a couple of really large legacy databases, and begin by remediating those. Then you can look at the benefits that you actually receive and you can extrapolate from those across the rest of the enterprise. The other thing I would say, following up on what Alicia said, is not only do a proper records retention schedule, but use what records managers call a big bucket theory of retention. The more records retention categories you have, the more likely that records will both proliferate as well as be misfiled. If you use a couple of dozen categories, then you'll find it much easier to bring your records management system under control as well as to apply electronic records management techniques.
That was good. And Jim, just to be fair, you can give two tips as well if you want.
Yeah. I mean,
everyone's given two thus far.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, I mean, policy is, once you have a policy in place, and include your legacy tapes, because the volume of data that's stored offsite in salt mines is probably more than sitting in-house in your corporate networks, and that's where the you know, the gotchas kind of, or the liability, hidden liability can lie. But you know, the key thing is, if you taking action now and being a bit more proactive about this, it'll be a smarter way to do it, because if you have to do it in a reactive you know, fire drill method, it's going to be very expensive and very painful. So take action.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alicia, Gary, and Jim, for joining us on another show here. It's always a pleasure to have speakers like you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later in the year. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So, however you choose to remember us, come back to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schoeneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.